Thanks for coming, folks. I'm really, really excited that Mark Guzdial.
Very good.
I've been practicing. He's here. I've pronounced it about 12 different ways in the course of my life. And I'm really glad that he agreed to come. We have a lot of Mark fans here for various reasons. People who know his work, people who know him personally. And he's just such a bright light in the area of computer science education research. And we've got a bunch of people here who really care about that. And I thought this would be a great opportunity to kind of hear it from, you know, one of the real founders of the field in many ways. So I'm really glad that he's here. I wanted to start off just saying a couple words. I think I've been thinking about this a lot. Why would a computer science education researcher be in a computer science department? And I think that maybe Mark will speak to this a little bit. But the thought that I had that I think is kind of like, there are people who do physics education, but they're not typically in physics departments. They're in education departments. So what's weird about computer science? And I want to say one of the things that's weird about computer science and is interesting about computer science is the thing that makes computer science so cool to many of us in the first place, which is recursion and self-reflection, right? And I think this is a real deal here, right? So it doesn't really make sense to do physics research on physics education. You don't view the students as particles reflecting off of each other, right? It's kind of a stretch. But to think about computer science research happening about computer science education is perfectly reasonable. You're developing software structures that make it easy to build things. You're developing systems that people can interact with. You're measuring how well they learn this material. It really can be computer science research about computer science research. I'm sorry, computer science education research about computer science education. So, and that just feels so natural because we can, you know, data is program, program is data. We love this stuff. So I don't know if that's what got you excited about it, but the more I thought about it, the more that seemed kind of fun. But I would really like to hear from Mark. So thanks, Bob.
Cool. Thank you, Mike. So I'm actually going to disagree a little bit about the physics thing. Most people who publish in the American Journal of Physics are in physics departments, but they don't necessarily get the respect. There's a real issue. No, serious. A physics education researcher is growing into physics departments, because that's where physics education research started. There's a real issue there about tension. It's similar for math education researchers in math education. But thanks very much. I am at the School of Interactive Computing in the College of Computing at Georgia Tech. We have our own College of Computing, not computer science. I can tell you that story later if you're interested. And we have three schools now, School of Computer Science, School of Computational Science and Engineering, and my school, School of Interactive Computing. So here's the story that I want to talk to you about today. Computing is important for more than those who just to choose to major in computing. That may seem obvious to folks in the audience, but I want to make a really strong claim about that, that the majority of people need to know about computer science, and it's certainly not the majority that are coming into our classes. While enrollment is an uptick, it's still not where it was. What do they need from computer science, and how is it that they're learning it now? So, at Georgia Tech, we now teach computer science to absolutely everybody who walks onto campus, and that's been a hard issue. It did not work for several years, and I'll tell you what I mean by it does not work. In particular, I want to argue that what we know about what students need who are not in computer science, but who need to learn about computer science, could be helped with a lot of technology. Now, here's one particular place where I'll strongly agree with Mike. We as the computer scientists are the ones who can build the technology to make the teaching more effective. And if anybody's going to figure out how to make educational technology work well for their discipline, it should be the computer scientists. And so I'll talk about these three stories as we go along. So here's a description of our typical CS student, the ones that we expect to graduate from our classes. We want somebody who's going to be a future software engineer, who will know how to produce reliable, robust, secure software, can work in interdisciplinary teams, can use appropriate design notations, can work in lots of different kinds of programming languages. This is what we want. This is what we expect that the students in our classes want. There's not so many of these. This is from the 2010 Tolby survey, and while there is a clear uptick in the last couple of years, right? That's a big gap between where it was. And according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we could keep getting students at this level and we would still find jobs for all of them. The graph on the right is the one that came up in the New York Times recently saying CRA has announced there's an uptick, but it's not the uptick that we might expect or hope. And it's certainly not what our economy could use. When I was a graduate student, my advisor made all of his students, Elliot Salwick at the University of Michigan, made all the students read C.P. Snow's The Two Cultures. If you're not familiar with this book, C.P. Snow was a science advisor in the UK during World War II, and he wrote this book because he saw that there was a split going on in Western civilization between the humanities and the sciences. He mostly saw this during decisions made during World War II. There were scientists making decisions without really considering the humanitarian aspects of it. There were humanitarians making decisions without really understanding the science of it. He blames the problem entirely at the feet of the humanitarians because he says that they see science as only one way of coming to know as opposed to one that is particularly well based in evidence. But not to take sides in the debate. Elliot made everybody read this book because he wanted us to think about the students who aren't coming into our classes normally, about the other perspectives on the things that we wanted to teach. And if you think, well, that was 20 years ago, 40 years ago, that doesn't really matter anymore, consider issues of like denialism that say that, well, you don't want to have your kids get vaccines because, well, the science isn't really all that well proven. There is no human effect on global warming. There's still an awful lot of denial about science. So, who else wants what computer science has to offer? We recognize that computing is core to our modern society. It's core to innovation in many disciplines, but we don't have that many students who want to be CS majors. But the argument is that there are lots and lots of people who need computing. In fact, by one estimate from Brad Myers and his colleagues at Carnegie Mellon University, there are four times as many. That by 2012, there will be about 3 million software developers in the United States, and 13 million people who will program but will not be professional software developers. That means for every student in your class, there's another four or five on campus who need to be in your class, who need to know what it is that you're teaching. That's a pretty interesting statistic, and that suggests that the much larger problem of CS education are not the people who are choosing to be CS majors. So, what do these atypical CS students look like? Well, here's one, future computational scientist or engineer. They want to use computation as a way of enhancing understanding, not necessarily produce applications. I have a colleague in chemical engineering who writes MATLAB code every single day. He considers himself a computational engineer. He says for him, 100 lines is an enormous program. Okay? Typically his programs are 10 to 15 lines. And he says, no, look, if you look at my programs of 10 to 15 lines, if I followed the documentation standards you require in CS1, I'd have to write another 20 lines of documentation. Why would I do that? I'm never going to reuse those 10 lines again. I write it and I write the new 10 lines the next day. Why would I do that? I think he's got a point. They care about the products of the programs, not the programs themselves. They want to learn as few languages as possible. They are not going to go out and learn Haskell just because it's the cool new thing to learn. This is not what they're interested in. They will work in interdisciplinary teams, and for the ones that I work with, including software engineers, that when they want to produce something robust and reliable from what they're doing, when they need to scale, they go get some software engineers to work with them. Here's another one that we need to care about a lot, the future high school CS teacher. All right, and one of the real problems, I'm not going to get into it in this talk, but one of the real problems of computer sciences enrollment is that students just aren't seeing computer science in high school. If we wanted to have more computer science in high school, we need a lot more high school teachers. Who should be teaching them? So as to get back to Mike's earlier point, okay, who should be combining physics for the future high school physics teacher? Should people the focus just in education, or those who know something about physics? Who should be defining what the high school computer science teacher should learn? Is it the people who just focus on education? Well, that gave us classes in Microsoft Word and keyboarding. How about more the computer scientists get involved? These are folks who are interested in learning code in order to be able to explore and understand ideas of computation and express it to their students. They certainly do not want to learn new languages unless it's necessary for their students. They care about what their students need to learn. And these folks are going to deal with students with a wide range of interests, but many of these teachers may never even meet a professional software engineer. Here's another one that you might not think about, graphics designers, people who mostly ignore science and mathematics when they're going through school. A lot of graphics designers, as I'm going to argue to you in a few minutes, are learning how to code, either to automate processes in Photoshop and GIMP, or else to put things on the web. These are self-depictions of graphics designers from a graphics designer website focused on coding. Those things exist now. These folks want to do as little coding as possible. They are not interested in programming for programming's sake. They are certainly not going to go learn Haskell because it's cool. They are probably never going to work with professional software engineers because they don't like software engineers. But we're going to, as I'll describe, they need to know a lot about computer science. How do we meet this need for all of these other folks? In general, our track record, even with students who want to be computer science majors, is not so good. 30-50% withdrawal and failure rates is the issue throughout the Western world. Other majors tend to be more female and more ethnically diverse than the typical computer science student, and our track record with those folks is also poor. We're not a very diverse field. So we need to think again about how we teach computer science if we want to teach to the majority. Technology can help, and we should lead. All right? If anybody's going to figure out how to do educational technology, we would hope that it'd be the computer scientists. In particular, educational technology should be really effective at teaching computer science. You're teaching about the same thing. It's not like we have to invent molecules again. I mean, we're teaching computing on computing. It should be really easy for us. We should be the ones to figure this out. So I'm going to talk about three particular needs in trying to teach computing to the majority, to the rest of us, to the people who aren't going to be CS majors. The first, I'm going to talk about the importance of context in teaching computing, and then talk about a technological need to match or tailor context to make sense to students. The second, why aren't the majority looking to our classes in CS? Where are they looking for information about computer science? And I'm going to argue that we need a new kind of a search engine that can help amateur, non-CS professional students find the computing resources that they need. And third, how can we teach CS with less programming? We currently teach CS in a really apprenticeship model. There ought to be better ways, and particularly this is going to be important for teaching the vast numbers of high school computer science teachers that we need. In fall 1999, Georgia Tech decided that every student who walked in the door had to take a course in computer science. The definition of that course is actually pretty rigorous. One of the learning objectives is that students, after they complete the course, need to be able to make choices about both algorithm and data structures. One semester, you've got to know how to do things in at least two ways so that you can make choices between algorithms and data structures. That's fairly rigorous. So it's considered part of the general education requirement. From 1999 to 2003, only one course met the requirement. For several years, we used Russ Shackelford's pseudocode approach, and then we shift to the Teach Scheme How to Design Programs book. I know you can't read this. That's okay. Let me explain a little what's going on here. This is the data from the last three semesters of offering this class. So this is everybody, just the females, just the males, all females, males, all females, males. Red is withdrawal or failure. Blue is passing the class with an A, B, or C. What you see immediately is the women are failing at nearly twice the rate of the men in some semesters. Overall, the pass rate of this course was 78%, which is pretty high for a CS1 course. Until we start breaking it down by major, remember this is absolutely everybody. Okay, architecture, 46.7% success rate. Okay, 53.5% for economics. Management is huge at Georgia Tech. 48.5% of them were passing the class. Management students started talking about three-peating the course. By the third time you take the course, almost everybody passes. Okay, these are really bad statistics, and it's bad campus-wide. Right? Why would somebody in, say, liberal arts want to collaborate with somebody in computer science when we're flunking out more than half their students? Now, at the same time as that we were dealing with this problem, there were a lot of research results coming out studying the issues of computer science curriculum. Probably the best of these is Unlocking the Clubhouse, Margolis and Fisher, talking about women in computing at Carnegie Mellon University, but also the Tech Savvy Report from the American Association of University Women, reports from the AAAS. They all say about the same thing. Computing courses are perceived by students to be tedious, boring, and irrelevant. I am willing to grant you tedious and boring. Everybody has programmed in such a way that it gets to be tedious and boring. Irrelevant seems totally bizarre. How can students find computing irrelevant? Computing is everywhere in their lives. Okay? Well, think about it from their perspective. A student who enters into your computer science course willingly is there because they think that things like being able to write on the screen is cool. Wii's are cool. ATMs are cool. You can get money out of a box. This is all really wild stuff. And what do we do? When they come into our classes, we say to them, hey, would you like to solve the Tower of Hanoi? I bet you don't know how to compute the 100th Fibonacci number. Why would they care? All right? What's the connection between what we're teaching in Computer Science 1 and what students perceive as being the value of computer science? So since spring 2003, Georgia Tech actually offers three different introductory CS courses. And this is based on an idea of Margolis and Fisher about having alternative paths into computer science. Each of these courses teaches computer science using a particular context, an application area that binds the examples, the homeworks, the lectures, everything together. The idea is to make computing relevant in the terms that the students recognize as being important about computer science. So we now teach three different courses, the one for our majors and also most of the science majors. This course is now using robots. I'll talk about that in a little bit. Computing for engineers is very much like the Teach STEAM approach. David Smith, when he wrote the book, really aimed to make it like what we were doing with STEAM, but it's all in MATLAB, because MATLAB is an engineering programming language. The students recognize that this is about engineering, and all the problems are drawn from engineering. I got the third group of students, architecture, management, and liberal arts students, and I developed an approach called media computation. So the idea of media computation is teaching computer science in a context that is relevant for these students. For liberal arts, architecture, and management majors, computer science is less about, or computing rather, is less about calculation than it is about communication. And so learning to manipulate digital media is something which the students find relevant. We're talking about the same kinds of computer science. In every kind of CS1, you're going to do something with a large aggregate data structure where maybe you're going to walk all the elements of the array and find the maximum or compute the average. We do the exact same thing, except we're going to compute the grayscale or the negative of a picture. Okay? In every sort of a computer science class, you do something with only part of the data structure. We do the same thing, but we remove red eye without changing any of the red that's on the person's clothes. We talk about algorithms. It turns out the algorithm by which you have one picture fade into another is exactly the same algorithm, a weighted sum, by which you would have one sound fade out while another sound fades in. Exactly the same process. And then we get to get into some really interesting ideas that we rarely get to touch on in computer science, but are super powerful. This picture down here is taking the words, "This is a test," and mapping the samples to colors in a pixel. You can see, "This is a test." Well, now you can't, now that I scribbled all over it, but that's what's there. We then write another piece of code that goes from the picture back to the sound again. And all the students who were doing Facebook, the back of their heads sort of explode because we just took sound out of a picture. And now we can talk about information being totally separate from any sort of medium. This is the kind of code students are working on. We're dealing with this in Python. This is like first 2-3 weeks of the class. Define clear red of the picture for each pixel and the pixel of the picture. Set the red of each pixel to 0. That goes from Santa Claus to the green-blue Santa. We can do grayscale by computing the average of the red, green, and blue, and then use that luminance value for all of the red, green, and blue. That gives us the grayscale Santa. Since each of these values of red, green, and blue varies between 0 and 255, 255 minus that amount is the negative of that color, and that gives us the dark elf or goth Santa look. One of the things that's really cool about this class is that we do a lot of assignments that are completely open-ended. Not in terms of the computing, but in terms of the media. So for example, we have a common assignment. Students are asked to make a collage where the same picture has to appear at least 3 times. They have to composite it all into one canvas and then mirror the whole canvas in one direction or the other. After the first time they composite it on, it has to be the first time it has to be the original form. The next two times could be anything they want to it. Scale it, crop it, change the colors. And so we get images like this, like this, and like this. We do similar things with movies. I want at least 3 things moving at once, and I don't really care what. We do similar things with sounds. Make me a collage of sounds where you can use any effects that you want. This is the next 3 semesters after we started with the media computation approach. Again, this is all females, males, and so on. What you'll see immediately is that the amount of redness has decreased. In fact, in some semesters, the women are doing better than the men. Okay, but remember, that was the last data I showed you with everybody on campus. Now these are just the liberal arts, architecture, and management students. So it makes sense to look at those individual majors. And what we see is that the pass rate rose pretty dramatically. From the previous version in STEAM into the media computation. People usually at this point say, what happened to the history majors, okay? If you really want to major in history, would you come to Georgia Tech? This is about 12 students, okay? There's a lot of interpersonal variability. Was the class successful? The first semester, Andrea Forte, who's now at Drexel, ran this huge evaluation effort across all three the courses. And I didn't get to see the data until the day I turned in all the grades, and then she, because of the conflict of interest. And then she plopped all these interview data, and I loved the first one, it's still my favorite. I just wish I had more time to play around with that. and make neat effects, but Jess, which is the ID we give them, will be on my computer forever. So that's the nice thing about this class, you could go as deep into the homework as you wanted. So I turned it in, then me and my roommate would do more after to see what we could do with it. Pretty cool. A year later, we followed up with all the students that we could reach, and 19% of the respondents had programmed since the class had ended. Most of them had written some piece of code to generate HTML, because if you have to build something complicated in HTML, it's much easier to do a piece of code than to do it by hand. Did the class change how you interact with computers? One of the responses definitely makes me think of what is going on behind the scenes of such programs like Photoshop and Illustrator. I should explain, in general, the response to the question, did the class change how you interact with computers? About 80% of the students said yes. The 20% of the students who said no made us realize that we should have pilot tested the survey first. Did the class change how you interact with computers? Well, let's see, I use a mouse and a screen and a keyboard. No, I interact with computers exactly the same way every day. Other schools have now been adopting media computation and publishing the results. At SIGSE 2005, Allison Tu published data from class at Gainesville College, a small two-year school in northern Georgia, where they also had a pretty dramatic improvement in their success rates. Pat Troy and Bob Sloan at the University of Illinois Chicago also had a dramatic improvement in their success rate. That's really important to me because UI Chicago is much more diverse. And I talked earlier about our challenge is trying to make our ways of teaching computer science work for a more diverse audience. Yes?
Quick question. I thought the first class was for the sciences and for CS, and I couldn't help noticing biologists in the media computation class.
Oh, right. I should explain. Thank you. Yeah. Biologists are given the choice of any of the three CS ones. Okay. And we get most of them. And I actually think that's a problem because the biologists end up doing, those who go on into doing things like large-scale simulations end up doing a lot of MATLAB stuff. So it's probably better for them to take the engineer CS one, but yeah, that's a particular issue, right? One of the questions we asked all the students is, would you like to take more computer science after? For a long time, Gainesville and Georgia Tech, we did the same surveys in each. And would you like to take more computer science? Georgia Tech, 15.2% of the students strongly disagreed, which is colloquially known as hell no. Less than 25% of the students agreed that they would like to take more computer science. We asked them, would you like to take more media computation? Over 40% of the Georgia Tech and Gainesville students said that they would, that they agreed or strongly agreed, which is pretty striking. Question, do they think that media computation isn't computer science? That's one possibility. Another possibility is, I've heard what computer science classes are like. I'd like some more of this one, please. At University of California, San Diego, Beth Simon has led an effort to move media computation into the class for majors. They're using the Java Media Computation course. And if you know Beth, who is the Energizer Bunny of CS Education Research, she is by far the most prolific researcher in the field, she's gathered lots of data. She's been following the last cohort that didn't take media computation and the first cohort that had. And what she's found is the media computation students have higher pass rates and higher retention rates 1 year later, which is a pretty striking result. Into the sophomore year, after only the one course in media computation, they're still more likely to be CS majors. She also found when she analyzed the two classes that media comp has more of a focus on problem solving and less on language. We're not covering as much of Java. We're covering more on problem solving and the students stick with it longer. So we now want to offer a second class. A weird thing happens when you don't flunk out half the students. Some of them want some more. So we now have developed a media computation data structures class, where the driving question of the class is, how did the wildebeest charge over the ridge in Disney's The Lion King? Anybody know the answer to that one? Why was that interesting in terms of computer animation? It was the first time that Disney didn't draw their characters. The wildebeests were all modeled on a computer, and then they did a herd simulation. For me to explain to you, what does it mean to model a wildebeest in the scene? I've got to explain to you things like linked lists, trees, and networks. To be able to do simulations, I have to explain to you things like stacks and queues. So to explain that 30 seconds of footage, I've got to explain all of the basic data structures. Lana Yarosh, who now works with Gregory Abbott, is about to graduate soon, helped me in answering a particular question. So is context still useful in the second course? We're teaching the second CS course. I mean, for our own majors, at some point you say, look, we're studying operating systems. It doesn't matter which operating system. We're studying generic ideas of operating systems. At what point do you pull away from talking about particular contexts? So she did a really interesting interview with a set of students over the course of the semester, analysis of the interviews quickly enough that she could come up with a survey of the statements that came out of the interviews so that students as a class could agree or disagree with each of these. 11% of the students agreed with the statement, working with media is a waste of time that could be used to learn the material in greater depth. One of the quotes from the interviews was, "I didn't take this class to learn how to make pretty pictures." On the other hand, the majority of the class agreed or strongly agreed that working with media makes the class more interesting. Students talked about doing more programming than was required just because they thought the programming assignment was fun. Here's a real challenge, okay? As you, as the teacher of a class like this, we don't know this for sure, but I'm going to predict the 11%, those are your best students. Those are the ones who just want to attach the fire hose, please feed me data structures as fast as you can, and I want to balance AV trees next week, please. On the other hand, if you knew that two-thirds of the class was really succeeding because they liked the context and they didn't want the fire hose, that's a hard class. We talked a little bit about the other two CS1s. So the one for engineers, it was developed in collaboration with a bunch of engineers. It's real engineering problems. Faculty from across campus gave us the problems that are used in the lectures, that are used in the homework. Among our three CS1s, these are the first students to program outside of class. Any MATLAB programmers in the room, can you guess why would these students be programming outside of their MATLAB CS1? Exactly right. They could visualize their multivariate calculus, and they'd never been able to before. Okay, so they all started using it for calculus right away. The success rate of this class also rose compared to everybody in the same class. So let me take a particular semester. Okay, so this is spring 2004. Here's the media computation class, here's the ones who fail, here's the engineering class, here's the CS class. There's about 1,200 students here, there's about 300 students here, there's about 150 students here. In spring 2004, more non-CS majors passed CS1 than the CS majors, by a long shot, given the numbers in the class. This is when we realized that the CS majors also don't like to compute the 100th Fibonacci number. They also need a context to help them understand why is this connected to what's important about, what I think is important about computer science. So we started an effort, it's now multi-years, with Bryn Mawr, Deepak Kumar, and Doug Blank to develop a robotics approach to CS1. Every student in the class goes out and buys this robot with a little dongle that's created by Tucker and his crew, with a Bluetooth on it, so all the robots are controlled wirelessly, and a camera, so they actually do a lot of media computation. They do movies. And that's actually what's going down in this bottom picture here on the right. This is actually one of the plays. Those are all robots, the characters. The robots wearing costumes. When they do it as a movie, there's a robot camera person that's simply taking pictures. What does it mean to zoom? Well, you go forward. What does it mean to pan? Well, you turn right. One of the cool things about that project is that it's inherently about parallelism and distributed processing. There's one laptop per robot. How does the robot know what its cue is? You know, you got to work that all out between all the different people with their laptops, and that's pretty cool. All right. So I've tried to argue for the last few slides that context is really important. Now, what we also point out, particularly with the data structures class, is that the same context doesn't work the same for everybody. How would you support students in finding the materials that are appropriate for them, or in finding materials and tailoring it to a particular context? That's a particular technology need that we could probably develop. So there's lots of content out in the world on learning computer science. Some of it is contextualized. If someone wanted to learn something about X, where X could be sorting, sampling, whatever, how would you help them find the right kind of material for their context? What are the variables that determine the right kind of a context? Is it about what level they are in school, what their major is, their desired degree, their previous background, how much computer science they've had? We need more than a search engine. We need a search engine that knows something about you and what your background is and what your interests are. Or we could imagine having content on, say, sampling, or content on, say, sorting, and say, oh, you want to learn about sorting and you care about industrial systems engineering? Let me talk to you about sorting an event queue, because that's something you have to do in simulations, and that's something in your major that people do. Piece number two. What do they need that we have to offer? So my student, Ryan Dorn, no longer my student, he's now just finished his first year at the University of Hartford, where he's an assistant professor. He studied graphics designers who program. You may be aware that Photoshop has been programmable for the last couple of versions in JavaScript. Most graphics designers are freelance consultants, so if they can batch process something, they're literally saving time, they're literally making themselves money. So they are teaching themselves how to program. And so Brian has done a bunch of interviews, assessments, actually developed some techniques for trying to teach these folks about computer science. And here's a quote from one of the subjects asking them, so would you take computer science classes? Well, yeah, I think that an academic study would make me a better programmer, but not by a whole lot. So what do they think software engineers do? The answer is the boring stuff. You're not going to be front-end anything with computer science. You're going to be back-end everything. And they're programming something, and they don't really see what it's going to look like. They're just making it work. Now, I want to be clear here. These are not undergrads. These are adults between 25 and 40 years old. These are professional graphics designers, and that's what they think software engineers do. That's who they think computer scientists are. So why don't they take CS classes? I started out in computer science, but didn't like it at all. So you weren't learning any concepts. You were learning the languages, and I didn't like that at all. So that's why I left. Okay. I've sat in lots of undergraduate curriculum discussions, and in all of them, the faculty will insist, we don't teach languages, we teach data structures and operating systems, and we teach all these different ideas. But when you get into the one-on-one at lunchtime or the happy hour and talking with their classes, well, that's the C class, and that's the Java class, and that's the Perl class. Okay? So maybe they're right. Maybe we really do think about it more in terms of teaching the languages and the concepts. One of the pushbacks I often get is, well, those graphics designers, they don't really want to code. Oh, no, no, no. They like code. Well, all right, the coding, I don't like to code. Because, I mean, the code is just, there's so much you can do with code and stuff, it's just like, wow. Right? Isn't this what you want all of your undergrads in CS to say? And this is what the graphics designers are saying. They really like what they can do with code. But they're really lost without the initial knowledge about things like computer science. Brian gave one of his subjects a piece of program that they needed to modify, and the student goes and starts Googling. All right, so the first thing that happens all the time, got a piece of code. How do I figure out what's going on in this code? Well, I look at things like variable names, variable name foo. I'll go over to Google, type in JavaScript foo. Surprisingly, that doesn't give them anything useful, but they don't know that, right? When they see try catch, they don't know that they should look up exception handling. I mean, what would link for them try catch to the idea of exception handling? Brian said that one of the subjects he gave a program to debug, they found themselves on a Java page, not a JavaScript page, and spent a half an hour on that page before Brian stopped them and said, this isn't going to be useful to you. Okay? They waste an awful lot of time. They learn from websites, they believe in code, code works, I can run code, I trust code, books where they can, but they want books written for them. Most books on computer science are written for people who care about science and mathematics, not for graphics designers who've ignored those things, for the most part, throughout their undergraduate career. So Brian did an experiment for his dissertation, it was published in ICER 2011. Two sources of information. One is a code repository, which is what, there's lots of graphics designers code repositories where they share code with one another. Another one with the exact same code, but with each of the pieces of code having a story about how that code was written. And in that story, you say things like, that's an array, that's called a Boolean, that's called a definite loop. Okay? And what he finds is that the people like the cases as much as the code repository, the people code the same, and the case users learn the concepts while the repository users do not. He's a really interesting way of thinking about how do we teach those people who aren't going to come into our classes, but need to learn about computer science. So, here's a third particular technological need. Given a piece of code, could you suggest the CS concepts and examples or productive appropriate search terms to them? Could you help them make the connection between try, catch, and accept, and exception handling? Could you say to them, look, foo is just a variable, that's completely arbitrary, but this other thing over here, that's an API reference. That's actually useful to you. Let me point out where the information is about that API. So this is like a search engine, but it's going to be one based on understanding code and having some knowledge about computer science to help people be able to find the things which are useful to them. And there's lots of things we might think about for building these. Could we just do a sort of a machine learning approach, give it a bunch of code, what search terms lead to useful results? Could we tag examples out there? Could we recognize certain patterns like, by the way, this is called recursion? Third one, teaching computer science is a study, not just an apprenticeship. For the most part, the way we teach computer science is an apprenticeship. We lecture to you a little bit, maybe we give you a book, but we expect that most of your learning of computer science is going to come from sitting in front of an IDE for many, many hours. Okay? That's the way we expect people to learn computer science. Now, practice is always important, but I wonder if we rely on it too much. Are we more like the rest of the STEM fields? I mean, the way that people learn biology is not by dissecting all the time. You can learn it from a book, you can read things, you can do simulations. The way you learn physics is not necessarily by doing experiments all the time. There's things you can study about physics. Now, architecture is much more of an apprentice-based learning. Students are expected to spend many, many hours in studio. But I'm going to suggest that our students, the students that we want to reach, can't always spend all of those hours essentially in a studio kind of setting. I suggest that no other science and engineering field teaches so much through practice. And that makes computer science particularly hard and time-consuming to learn. Okay, so can we teach about variables, behaviors, how loops work, all the rest of those sorts of things, where does the semicolon go, without having them fight it in front of the IDE? And we know that they fight it in front of the IDE. There are people like Matt Jay did, who's really made a career out of manipulating the IDE and then knowing exactly what's going on. And he can show you that an error, like you're writing a while loop, and before in Java, and before the first opening curly brace, you put a semicolon. Half an hour. It's going to take you a half an hour in a CS1 to figure out that you put that semicolon in the wrong place. Okay. Now imagine that you are a full-time high school teacher, and you only have hours in the evenings and the weekends to get any studying done, and you just lose a half an hour because you placed one semicolon in the wrong place. That's a real cost. Can we reduce the waste of time? I think of this as being sort of like learning a foreign language. If I just dump you in the middle of a foreign country, you will eventually learn the language. If I give you a little bit of syntax and grammar instruction first, is it easier? Does that help? Okay, we have a problem in computer science. There's too little secondary school computer science. This is the percentage of schools offering advanced placement computer science out of all of the high schools in the state. Georgia's down here at the highest. That's actually wrong. We're down to 20% now. This is stopping in 2009. 20% of high schools in Georgia offer AP computer science. That means that 80% of them don't. And we are by far the most in the Southeast. The number in Alabama, okay, it's down to 4. Not 4%, F-O-U-R. 4 teachers of advanced computer science out of 400 high schools in the state of Alabama. Okay, so NSF has a solution for this. They're trying to create a new kind of advanced placement computer science test, one that's not so programming centric, one that we could teach lots of high school teachers how to teach. So they're defining this new course at csprinciples.org, and the goal is to have CS10K, 10,000 teachers ready and able to teach this course in 10,000 schools by 2015. By the way, today, we have 2,000 AP computer science teachers nationally. They want to have 10,000. So first I'm going to claim they're not going to come from pre-service teacher education. We are not going to take students who are undergraduates today and teach them to be computer science teachers, for lots of reasons. You teach the program at University of Texas at Austin, actually is one of the few pre-service computer science teacher programs in the country, and in 15 years they've had 7 graduates. Purdue offers a pre-service AP, computer science teacher education program. They have 1 student. Okay. Now I've tried to figure out whether or not we could offer this in Georgia, and I've talked to lots of people who teach science education, math education, etc. Ask them whether or not we could do this. The problem is you can't use pre-service to ramp up a field. The major issue for any sort of a teacher education program is to keep the relationships with the teachers and principals where you're going to do student teaching. If you don't have teachers out there to place your students for student teaching, how can you possibly ramp up the numbers? Okay, it's a real chicken and the egg problem. So we're mostly going to teach, we're going to generate computer science teachers in service, existing high school teachers that we will teach to be computer science teachers. So we've been exploring how this is going on in Georgia. There is a program at Columbus State where they now have a CS endorsement as a kind of certification in computer science teaching. They have exactly 2 students. They just graduated their first student. The problem is that these adult professional students don't have the time to spend hours in front of the IDE. They don't have all the right background, and they get stymied by small errors. Here's a couple of quotes from Brenda Clara's paper. There were times that it would take me hours to find one comma out of place or find that one something that was wrong. So I didn't mind sticking with it, but it just got to the point where I just didn't get it. I mean, these are folks our age. These are folks professionals. They don't have a half an hour to find the missing semicolon. They want to study computer science the way that you would study other subjects. They're quite willing to program, but they need a lot more support, and they can't spend the hours at it that we normally expect undergraduate students in computer science to spend. So what are our options? Option number 1 is we give up on teachers. Okay, that's a viable option. Option number 2 is we figure out a pedagogy that works for in-service teachers. So some fairly famous names, David Patterson at Berkeley and Alan Kay, Turing Award winner, say, use technology instead. We should give up on using teachers in high school computer science. Okay? Now, I don't know if this is possible. I don't know if we know how to teach CS principles content at a high school level via technology to everybody across the country. It's a real interesting challenge. Option number two, figure out a way to teach high school CS teachers. Given a focus on in-service teachers, we need to have a distance education effort to fit within their schedules, and learning must happen primarily in 20 to 60 minute chunks, not 3 hours in front of the Eclipse. That's not going to happen. Now, we can learn from the Open University successes, but I've talked to folks at the Open University UK and the Open University Israel, and they don't have a solution. There is no complete solution for teaching computer science teachers online. If we're going to make this happen, we have to invent it ourselves, and something that can help us generate 8,000 teachers in 4 years. So, the rule number three, we need to rethink the way that we teach computer science. We need a new kind of a pedagogy, maybe a new kind of technology, where we could possibly do it with things like cognitive tutors, that's what Alan Kay is pushing for today, or can we build technology to guide teacher learning with less programming, where they can study computer science like you would study a book, maybe program within a book, an electronic book where you could actually program inside of it. One of the ideas that we're exploring, we have a new CE21 grant where we're going to computing education in the 21st century from the NSF, where this is the particular the problem that we're going to go after. And one of the things that we believe is, our idea is, a little educational psychology can go a long way. Most of what we know about instructional design has never been tried in computer science classes, at least if there's any published data on it, which is really shocking. I mean, I have a collaborator now, Richard Katchenbaum, in psychology, and we meet with his PhD students, and they're saying, nobody's tried worked examples. Nobody's tried multiple modality learning. These things don't happen. There's an awful lot of what instructional designers know about what's good instructional design that we've never tried in computer science. And I think it's high time that we try. The needs are out there. So, the argument I've tried to make is that computing is important for everybody, not just those few undergraduates who are coming into our CS courses as majors. Students who want computing to succeed with context, contextualized computing education seems to be working for us, at least at Georgia Tech. We need to figure out how to make that scale, how to provide providing to students the kind of CS education they need in the context that they need it. End user programmers want what computer science has to offer, and there's a lot more of them than there are professional software developers, but they don't know enough CS to find out what they don't know. They don't know how to find the things that they need. We need new kinds of tools to be able to help them navigate the amount of materials out there and find things that are best for them. And third is we need new kinds of pedagogy. We can't simply assume apprenticeship. Apprenticeship works if the students are going to grow up to be software developers. That's very authentic. It's the right thing to do. What about for everybody else? It can't be the same way. So, thanks to our supporters, especially the U.S. National Science Foundation that funds our work. Microsoft Research funded the work with robotics. And there's a bunch of URLs and pictures of our books. And thank you all very much.